This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Dallas loves the Cowboys. Pittsburgh loves the Steelers. Lots of other NFL cities feature fans who spend more than reason could dictate on season tickets, paint their faces in team colors, and sit in freezing weather howling like dogs, because some people in Cleveland still love the 0-16 Browns. But where are the roots of the love between a pro football team and the town where it lives? Upton Bell thinks he knows. He started learning the answer 57 years ago. And you were how old?
22 going on 10. It was a summer job, but with the idea that the following year, when I finished college, which I didn't, that I would come back and I would have a full-time job with the Colts.
Upton Bell is the son of Burt Bell, who was the commissioner of the NFL from 1945 until his death in 1959. So a summer job as a gopher in the league was natural enough for young Upton. He and sports writer Ron Borges recently joined me to talk about the Baltimore Colts of 1960 and beyond and the community of which they were the center. Upton Bell feels he was especially fortunate that his first employer was the Colts. He began feeling that way when he entered the team's training camp locker room for the first time to encounter quarterback Johnny Unitas, star receiver Raymond Berry, and defensive standout Gene Big Daddy Lipscomb, among others.
Every one of them walked over. Hi, kid. Your father was great. Welcome to the Colts. What can we do for you? Can you imagine getting that today? It was like I was almost already in the first few minutes in a family.
According to Ron Borges, who covered the Colts for a time, even fans without Bell's entree felt that way about the team in those days.
Johnny Unitas ran an acetylene torch at the Bethlehem Steel Plant in the mornings. Artie Donovan was a liquor salesman. A lot of these guys, they had to work, you know, and then they would go to their other job, which happened to be football.
So fans of the Colts could identify with the players, and the players were good with that. Borges says that at training camp, there were no ropes between Unitas and the working stiffs who came to see him. Beyond that, those Colts were good. They'd won championships in 1958 and 1959 for a town that needed a champion.
You know, Baltimore has the great inferiority complex. They're trapped between New York and Washington. There's no VIP room in Baltimore. In most cities, you got a VIP room for the athletes and the politicians. And, you know, in Baltimore, you went to Gussie's Downbeat, and it's just as likely you're going to run into Geno and Unitas and those guys as you would run into me and Upton. And I think Unitas set the tone. Unitas was about as down-to-earth guy as you were ever going to find in professional sports.
The accessibility of the players, Johnny Unitas in particular, bred familiarity, or at least the powerful illusion of familiarity. As Ron Borges puts it, the city of Baltimore embraced the Colts the way a small community sometimes embraces a high school team that wins a state championship. Bell feels as if those players who stayed around after they retired helped establish and reinforce the relationship between the team and the community, a relationship that the active players also enjoyed.
It was like watching an old movie of the guy that works in the shipyard, comes in, he has a shot and a beer, and he's talking to his buddy, oh, I got to go home, I've got to pay the bills. They might end up sitting next to one of the players, and the player said, oh, my God, I got hurt today, I can't stand the coach, he's a pain in the neck, oh, and you're never going to get that again.
Nope, you're probably not. Most of the players in today's NFL don't have to learn welding or drive a beer truck in the off-season. They may sign autographs at training camp, but they aren't ordering burgers with the fans when day is done. Such was already the case 33 years ago when the team Upton Bell recalls with such affection left town. That fact was indisputable. The team became the Indianapolis Colts, and the owner, Robert Irsay, became the most hated man in Baltimore. But it was a testament to the connection between team and city that numbers of citizens refused to acknowledge what had happened. The Baltimore Colts marching band did not disband. They played on as if there was still a home team for which to play. And as Ron Borges recalls, the band members weren't the only ones in Baltimore to firmly reject rejection.
And that fall, when what would have been the opening game of the season at Memorial Stadium, the band was there, even though the team was not. And one other person was, John Steadman, who was the leading columnist in town, who sat in the bleachers for four quarters and then wrote a column. You know, there's no team here, but we're here. Baltimore is still here in this stadium. And they, you know, they fought and fought and fought to get a team back. And ultimately, in true American fashion of the 2000s, they stole somebody else's team and got it back.
Cleveland. They stole Cleveland's team. Or maybe the people of Baltimore were just receiving stolen goods. Doesn't matter. Or at least in one sense, it doesn't matter to Upton Bell. Sure, he says, the Ravens won the Super Bowl in Baltimore, but no team's ever going to capture the hearts of the people there the way the Colts did back in the late 50s and early 60s. And maybe Bell is right. But by building that powerful bond between team and community, the Colts became the envy of every other team in the league, and they gave the Cowboys, the Patriots, the Steelers et al. Something to which they could aspire. Brand loyalty built on something more human than mere brand. But would Upton Bell want to see the return of those days when the players were without entourages, when they lived down the street from the plumbers and the grocery clerks rather than in gated communities with the movie stars?
I don't want it to come back because I had it and a few other people had it. You're never going to see again.
Maybe not, but what we do see every weekend and on Monday and Thursday nights as well and on a couple of Saturdays once the playoffs begin is the contemporary version of what those Colts created in Baltimore. Loud enthusiasm bordering on hysteria for whoever's wearing the home team's jersey. You can learn more about the Colts of the 60s from Upton Bell's new book, written with Ron Borges. It's titled Present at the Creation, My Life in the NFL and the Rise of America's Game. It's time for three stories you should know. The NFL regular season is over. We're going to begin this week by examining some of the numbers in its wake. I'm joined by The Ringer's Claire McNear and The Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Welcome back to both of you.
Bell.
Hey.
Claire, your turn first.
Well, the results are in, and this year's NFL ratings were abysmal. League-wide viewership was down 9.7% over the 2016 regular season, which itself was down 8% from 2015. There have been a lot of theories about why there's been such a big drop-off, everything from cord-cutting to political turmoil to the rise of fantasy football. The one I find most persuasive is that this year we saw a stunning number of season-ending injuries to some of the league's biggest stars. Injuries took down Aaron Rodgers, Carson Wentz, Deshaun Watson, David Johnson, Richard Sherman, J.J. Watt, Julian Edelman, Odell Beckham Jr., the list goes on and on and on. So as we begin to think about the still far-off 2018 season, when most or all of these big stars will be back, do you guys think that things will get better for the NFL in viewership, or is the NFL trending downwards for good?
I mean, isn't it fair to say this is part of a broader shift that's happening to television overall? All you need to do to see what's happening out there is to watch television with someone under 25 because they don't really actually watch television anymore. Everything is just appointment tablet viewing. The whole idea of social media highlights and so on, you don't have to sit and watch a sporting event first quarter, second quarter, third. You don't miss anything now. The whole idea that you have to be on the couch for a certain hour of a certain day has radically changed, and that's affecting everything across the dial. I think, Claire, I mean, am I mistaken that primetime ratings for numerous kinds of shows, they're all down. So what explains Nickelodeon's drops? Aaron Rodgers getting hurt? I think this is a bigger thing going on.
Well, you
on
may
here.
Be onto something there. So, Jason, you're suggesting that this horrifying and precipitous drop really has nothing to do with football at all.
I'm curious to hear what Claire thinks, but my take on it is that everyone's jumping in here a little bit and stirring the political pot. Of course, you have people who want to suggest that this drop is entirely due to the political protests that have been happening in the NFL. I don't buy that. It's a much more complicated situation. You look at the top 20 shows for 2017, I guarantee you two-thirds, if not more, of them will be football games. So as grim as things might be for the NFL internally, most leagues would kill to have those numbers. All leagues would kill to have those numbers.
I actually have that stat in front of me, and NFL programming made up 33 of the 50 most watched programs in 2017.
I have to correct one thing that you said, Claire. I have not yet begun to think about the 2018 season.
Fair.
And you'll have a long wait until I do. But anyway, I just wonder, it seems to me that the reason that pro football became so popular has a lot to do with how brilliantly it was marketed over the years. I wonder if it's suddenly not being marketed as well. Have they done something badly that they used to do brilliantly? And does that, to some extent, explain the lower numbers?
Yeah, I mean, that's been a major defense by networks that are having to defend these ratings, saying that, you know, the product has been diluted, that there are too many games on Thursday or early Sunday morning in London, and there's just too much of it, so it's not really appointment viewing in the way that it used to be. But it is true, what Jason says is true, that ratings in primetime are down pretty much across the board, but there are exceptions. You know, NBA viewership is up 20% over last season. So it's not clear that this is just sort of a sign of the times for the NFL.
All right, we're going to stick with the NFL for my topic. Since the regular season ended, the Oakland Raiders have been accused, and I'm quoting now, of skirting the Rooney Rule. And that's the rule that stipulates that when you're hiring a new head coach, you have to interview minority candidates. Denver Broncos and the Los Angeles Chargers, meanwhile, have hired black coaches, which means that we now have 8 head coaches who are black in the NFL, unless one of them has been fired since I began the sentence. The Rooney Rule, which came into being in 2003, has been celebrated. It's also been mocked. Some black candidates have said, I'm not going to go through the charade of being interviewed because I already know they're going to hire the white guy. Some people feel that this rule is responsible for the number of black head coaches. 8 is pretty high, historically, for the NFL. Other people feel that the rule is a publicity stunt which enables the NFL to say, see, we care about such things as minority hiring. I think it's a shame that there is a need for such a rule, but I'm afraid that there is still a need for such a rule. And if anybody wants to suggest a better way to give minority candidates a fair shot at head coaching positions, I'm listening. Jason?
Yeah, I mean, I think what is the case here is the truth is somewhere in between, right? The reality is the NFL has a need to continue to widen its coaching candidate pool. And on the other hand, the rule is probably a little bit of this artificial construct that feels a little strange for teams, especially when they want to go out and grab one guy, as the Raiders with John Gruden. I do feel, however, you need devices in place to prevent something that happens in a lot of leagues and a lot of coaching searches, which is just recycling the same candidates over and over and over. I mean, that's something that's kept good African-American candidates from getting jobs, but also good candidates in general from getting jobs, because you're just doing all that recycling. And anything that gets them out of that loop, I'm in favor of.
Yeah, I mean, you know, either you care about the rule or you don't. And the Lions paid $200,000 in a fine when they did not interview minority candidates back in 2003. And, I mean, it's clear to anybody who's been paying just the slightest bit of attention to this that the Raiders had set their minds on Gruden. And, you know, there are reports that he's been hiring a staff even while they were in the midst of ostensibly interviewing other candidates. And apparently they're not going to be fined for it. But, I mean, it's, you know, it's either a token thing or it's not. And if it's a sham, call it a sham. And if Mark Davis can't afford the fine, maybe he could ask the good taxpayers in Nevada to spot him.
Well, I guess one advantage to the rule is even when a team knows exactly which white guy they're going to hire, if they have to call in a couple of minority candidates to interview, somebody notices that these guys have been interviewed. And then the next time around, maybe they get taken more seriously. I don't know if that is even excuse enough for the rule.
Yeah, I mean, you do feel sympathy for a good candidate who is feeling that they're getting brought in for this sham interview process. No one should be put in that kind of circumstance.
No.
Just for a look.
All right, Jason, let's not delay any longer. You really have an important message for us this week.
Yeah. Well, we got a big college football game Monday night, the national title game between the University of Georgia and the University, I believe it's Alabama.
I'd be surprised.
In Alabama. It's going to be crazy down there. The tickets cost as much as a Mercedes-Benz, and it's being played in the Georgia Mercedes-Benz Dome, the new dome down there in Atlanta. It's going to be crazy. And to make it just especially insane, look who's coming, the President of the United States, Donald Trump. And look, you know, we have a tradition in this country of presidents going to big-scale sporting events. I don't begrudge him that opportunity, but someone needs to tell the president, do you know how long a college football game lasts in 2018? It is insane. We now have games that begin shortly past 8 o'clock that drift way past midnight. This game is going to easily hit midnight, if I guess correctly, and I just don't know if the president is in for the long haul. Is it okay for him to leave after a quarter? Can he take a nap at halftime? Has anyone briefed him about the incredible creep of the college football experience in the last 10 years? I need to know.
Claire, I hope you can provide an answer. Jason sounds desperate.
Well, you know, I have not spoken to Trump's team about this, but the last time he went to a college game, which was last year's Army-Navy game, I believe he did not stay the whole time. So he has a history of leaving early. And, I mean, Monday is going to be a long day for the guy. He's going to be in Nashville earlier in the day, and at 5 p.m. he's got the all caps, most dishonest and corrupt media
That's
awards.
That's right.
Are we in contention?
You know, I think we all might be. I'm not sure. I guess we'll find out. But, you know, it's going to be a long day, even if you're not a 71-year-old trying to get home in time for Hannity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Jason, I read your story on this topic, and it was very good. But you acknowledged in the story that watching another bowl game, you had fallen asleep. And so I can't really see how you can argue that a college football game is too long if it works that well as a sleep aid. If it was any shorter, you might not have gotten as much rest that evening.
This is true, but that's not what these games are supposed to be about, Bill. They're not supposed to be putting us to sleep. They're supposed to be thrilling us for generations.
No, they're supposed to be selling tires and beer.
Bill, someone, Claire, Bill, someone is going to say it. I'm going to say it. What about the kids? What about the kids? I mean, these kids, they have school the next day. They have to trudge through the snow if they live on the East Coast. And how do they possibly fall in love with the sport of college football if they can't even stay up to watch the national title game? You got to think about the kids, Bill and Claire.
Well, it's going to be a weekend of thinking about the kids, obviously. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Wall Street Journalist Jason Gay. Thank you very much, Jason. You all right?
I'm just worried about the kids, Bill.
And the Ringer's Claire McNear. Thank you, Claire.
Great to be here.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. Old Man 1952 recently left this review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. Sports reporting has become overcome by the 24-hour chase for controversy that has plagued the rest of journalism. This program is a refreshing antidote. Escape the news and enjoy weekly stories that remind you of why you loved sports in the first place. Yes, there is still a place for healing humor. Thanks, Old Man 1952, and if you've ever considered recommending Only a Game to others, do me a favor and do it now while you're thinking about it. We love to see your love on Facebook, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, and those reviews really do help other listeners to find our show.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This, with the recommendation for another podcast for you to check out, namely How I Built This. Every week, I talk to the people behind some of the most inspiring companies and brands in the world, with stories of incredible persistence, grit, and insight. You can find How I Built This on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lael Wilcox is one of the greatest living athletes in a sport you've probably never heard of, self-supported ultra-endurance bike racing. Competitors push themselves for thousands of miles and days at a time with no help.
Physically, it's really degrading. It's like I'm out there bleeding all over the place, coughing up green phlegm, like bloody noses, aching knees.
But pursuing professional sports can have other costs, too. Reporter Will Huntsbury begins the story with a Trans Am, a coast-to-coast bicycle race.
4,228 miles, to be exact, from Oregon to Virginia. When Lael pulled up at the starting line in June of 2016, she was surrounded by impressive athletes, men and women.
They're all tall and fit. They all have bike kit on. I'm wearing a cotton t-shirt like usual. I tucked my t-shirt into my spandex shorts to be more aerodynamic. I was kind of like, okay, get serious, you know?
About 90 people rolled out of the starting line. The best of them expected to get across the country in 17 days or so.
I just started hammering. I was just like, take off.
Lil's boyfriend, Nicholas Carman, followed her pace online. He's her biggest supporter and kind of her de facto coach.
So there's lots of talent in the first 2 days. And then after the third day, it looks like the way the race is going to look the rest of the time.
After that third day, Lil was holding strong between third and fifth place, which sounds pretty good. But she had set the bar super high for herself.
I was kind of bummed out. I was like, what the hell am I doing? These guys are killing me.
An Australian woman and a German guy were staying steady in the lead.
I just took it for granted that it was going to be easy, and it was not.
Did you think she was going to win?
Not really, but it's kind of a long game.
Lail hung in the long game long enough for the Australian to fall behind. That left her and the German, Stefan Strike, heading into the final days.
He kept asking people. He was like, where is she? How far back is she? You know, he had to know because he, like, knew I was coming after him.
Stefan slept less and less each night, trying to keep his lead. But by the last night, Lil had cut it down to 20 miles. She slept for 30 minutes in a bush on the side of the road.
And I was like, okay, this is it. I'm going. Chase a caffeine pill with a five-hour energy, and I'm like, I'm on it. Getting Stefan.
The Trans Am race had never been won by a woman, and neither had any other major self-supported race. So Lail's run on the leader wasn't just important for her, but for the whole sport. Some of the people in the Trans Am, racing's their whole world. But Lail came to this sport in a very different way. It all started back in college, when Nicholas gave her her first bike.
So we met, I guess, 10 years ago, almost 11 years ago.
Get it right.
We started riding together. I mean, Nick is really the reason I started riding bikes at all.
Lail never owned a car, and she fell in love with bikes. One day, she and Nicholas decided to ride 45 miles from Tacoma to Seattle, and she basically had an epiphany.
It was just like this huge idea. I never knew anybody did that. But I was like, this is so cool. We could just ride. If we rode like this every day, day after day, we would just cross the country on bikes.
After Lail graduated, they decided to do exactly that.
But we didn't have any money, like zero money.
They worked for the summer to save up.
And then started our first trip that fall.
They rode down along the entire East Coast.
And it was awesome. We were chasing the fall colors all the way down.
That started a six-year migratory cycle. They'd do odd jobs for a few months in one place, saving money. Then they'd travel for a few months. They went all over the world that way.
You'd learn the street names and the local hangouts, and you'd make new friends, and you'd just understand the local culture. And whether that was a new language or just kind of a new place, you'd truly understand it.
They toured the Middle East, Africa, the U.S., and Mexico.
And what we've achieved is happiness. I mean, that's our measure of success.
In the Western world, where people are increasingly unhappy.
Increasingly wealthy and increasingly unhappy. And no amount of money will buy happiness. But even still, people make that mistake all the time as they chase something and they don't find it. We found relative health and happiness in riding bicycles and not making a lot of money.
The happiness seemed like it could go on as long as they wanted. But then Lail began wanting to test herself in new ways. While they were in Israel, she heard about the Holy Land Challenge, an almost 1,000-mile race across the country. Lail was the only woman to enter and the youngest rider.
People just looked at me like I wasn't even going to be able to finish the first day. You know, they were kind of like, what is she doing here?
And then at the end of that first day, she was 25 miles ahead of everyone.
People just went crazy because they couldn't believe there was a woman in the front of the pack. You know, it was just like this big deal.
Lail didn't win, but obviously people took notice. Then she did another big race, and even though she had bronchitis, she beat the women's record. And that brings us back to the 2016 Trans Am. Lail was racing Stefan Strike for the lead, but she'd still never won a race.
So she woke up on that final morning, popped a caffeine pill, and
I'm like, I'm on it, getting Stefan.
What Lael didn't know is that almost that exact same moment, Stefan woke up too. He was ahead by 20 miles, but he started pedaling the wrong way.
And it's 3 a.m. We're in this town called Bump-Ass, Virginia. It's like a nothing town. And I see this light coming towards me. And I was like, what the hell's going on here? Like, why? You know, who is this?
It was Stefan headed right at her. Fatigue is such a big part of ultra-distance racing that it's not uncommon for a rider to wake up groggy and go the wrong way. When Stefan saw Lael, he turned around and immediately started following her.
I just started riding as fast as I could. I was like, wah, going crazy.
They rode neck and neck for 5 or 6 miles. But then Lael lost Stefan completely. She cruised in first to the finish where Nicholas and a crowd of people were waiting.
I finished. They put out like a little camping chair for me to sit in, take my shoes off, tell my story about the final night. Because everybody was like, what the hell happened out there? And it was awesome.
Up until then, many people said a woman couldn't win a race like this.
If you beat them, you beat them. That's what happens. And then everybody has to change the way they think.
Lael isn't the fastest rider you or I have ever seen. But somehow, at the end of 4,300 miles, she finishes ahead of 70 other people.
Could you beat Lael?
No comment. Lael says no, and I don't really care.
Both of them do agree on this. Nick would win in a short race. But Lael has a kind of super freak power. She can ride hundreds of miles every day with little sleep and just keep going. I met Lael last March in San Jose del Cabo. That's way down on the southern tip of the Baja Peninsula in Mexico. She was setting what's called a fastest known time of the peninsula, basically racing against herself. There were a few people waiting for her with a toilet paper finish line. They sprayed her with Tecates when she crossed.
Yeah! Woo! Yeah!
I've never seen in my life anyone look as stiff as she did when she stepped off that bike. She moved slow, like her joints didn't work right.
It's over. Yes. Yes. Whoa, that was so hard.
I gave her some time to rest and then met her and Nicholas in their motel room a few days later. It was a tiny room, one of the cheaper ones you could get in town, but clean and neat. Their bikes took up all the free space. Nicholas had a row of wine bottles stowed next to the bed.
Yeah, you guys have a great little wine cellar going over there, actually.
He grabbed a bottle.
And just fill that wine glass up.
Get this pink wine.
Nicholas opened it because Lael's hands were still numb from the ride. All the bouncing of the dirt roads had done something weird to her nerve endings. I was expecting to find someone stoked on their new career, but less than 10 minutes into the interview, she said something about racing that totally threw me. She said she thinks she's done, that she's accomplished all she wanted to. I was so confused.
It's like this racing, you don't stop for anything. You don't talk to anybody. You don't learn anything. You just hammer through as quickly as you can.
For 6 years, all Lael and Nicholas did was work and tour. But then 3 years ago, the racing started, and they haven't toured since. I realized Nicholas was really bummed.
I'd like to continue traveling at some point in the future. I'd like to think that she wants to put the racing behind her at some point and try not to impress too much on her, but I think that she wants to.
Try not to impress too much on me. He says it like every day that he hates the racing. I understand, though. It just like takes everything. It's all consuming.
Competitive sports aren't Nicholas's thing, but he's still proud of Lael.
Yeah, I'm extraordinarily proud of it, and I'm excited that she does it. I'm excited that she does anything that excites her, makes her happy.
But he got into biking for the touring.
One is very different from the other. The one is to encourage people to travel and speak another language and eat food. And the other is do something at a distance as fast as you can.
I started getting invested in the whole thing, wanting them to resolve it. I asked Nicholas if maybe the answer wasn't for him to pick up racing too.
You don't want to?
No, I don't have any interest in racing at all. It doesn't make any sense to me.
You know, there's that. He could be a great racer if he wanted to. He doesn't want to race. You know,
if I could. The question is, why would anybody want to do that? Not why wouldn't I want to do that, but why would anybody want to?
Yeah, good question. Why would anybody want to do that?
You're the outlier, not me.
I know. I'm the outlier. And, you know, I, my purpose, my focus is I do it because I can and I can win.
Nicholas, it seemed, would never get racing. Lael, on the other hand, she seemed really torn. Racing's brought her very little money and it wrecks her body. Touring, though, has this kind of soul-satisfying quality. But then again, she's got a physical genius for racing, and that's tough to let go. I walked outside. It was nearing sundown in the square. And then I let this project sit. I had interviewed Lael and Nicholas in their motel room last March, and when I finally came back to this, I knew I had to check in with them. I went to Nicholas's blog and read an entry from August. He wrote, "By some twisted miracle, Lael has gone her own direction without me, and I'll never understand it. Nearly 11 years of my life, most of which we lived at a vigorous pace where every hour is saturated in new experiences, seemed to have vaporized." Nicholas did the only thing he knew how to do. He got on a bike and started touring again. It's impossible to quantify the metrics of why any two people split. But something Lael had said in the motel room stuck with me. She set these big, unattainable goals for herself in every race.
I want to shoot for the stars every time. I'm always trying harder, or I'm always going for bigger miles. But then the result is that I'm not going to attain my goal. You know, it's like my goals are bigger than just winning.
In the end, Lael just couldn't shake that urge. I called her up a few weeks ago, and she said there's still records she wants to break. In fact, she's planning on racing again this summer.
That's reporter Will Huntsbury speaking with ultra-endurance cyclist Lael Wilcox. Lael hasn't decided which race or races she'll compete in this summer, but if you'd like to follow along with her adventures, we'll have links at onlyagame.org. NBA Hall of Famer Bernard King had a spectacular rookie season, and then, in the summer of 1978, he landed a role in a Hollywood movie.
I made more than Al Pacino shooting The Godfather for his movie. Yeah!
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? And what can a tuna cannery in the middle of the Pacific tell us about taxes? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator, a new podcast from Planet Money, where in every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the story of a marathon made up of 105 laps around the same track, which is surrounded by a wall and guards. But right now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
College football's champion will be determined on Monday when Alabama and Georgia face each other in the square off. Who do you like in that one?
The betting side of my brain says Alabama, but I watched Georgia play Oklahoma, and that's a very tough ball club. So I'll take a flyer and pick Georgia.
One team is already celebrating a national title. Who's doing that and why?
The University of Central Florida, who actually played extraordinarily well in their bowl game and looked like a lot of fun. They beat Auburn by a touchdown in the Peach Bowl, and they finished 13-0. So they've decided to go back to old-school college football and declare themselves a national champion.
Okay, so much for the championship bowl, whatever it's called. I want to test your knowledge regarding some of the lesser-known bowls.
Okay, absolutely.
I'm going to give you the name of a bowl game, real or imagined, and you tell me whether it's real or imagined. Okay, you ready?
Yeah, go.
All right, the Foster Farms Bowl.
That's real.
Yes, it is. Next, the Bad Boy Mowers Gasparilla Bowl.
That is not real.
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is?
Temple v. Florida, 1221.
Okay.
That's my favorite. All right. Now the Kraft Heinz Feed Hunger Bowl.
I'll say that's real.
Nope. Fake.
Oh, man. I'm not good at this at all.
Sounds real. It has two brand names in it.
That's exactly right. It fooled me because it was highly logoed.
How about the Fingerlings Finger Bowl?
Nope.
You're right.
Don't buy that one.
And finally, The AutoNation Cure Bowl.
Cure, like C-U-R-E?
That's it.
Does it, like, make your car feel better?
I cannot answer that without giving away everything.
But I think it's actually a real bowl.
It is. You did fairly well.
Yeah, I got fooled by that Gasparilla thing.
Well, almost everybody would. But how many of those bowl games, real or imagined, did you watch?
I watched a lot of bowl games this year, but I didn't watch any of those.
Especially the ones that didn't exist. All right. When we last spoke, the NFL's regular season had not ended, and now it has, and probably nobody's happier about that than the Cleveland Browns.
Yes, they don't have any more games they can lose.
That's right.
They went 0-16, one of two teams in the NFL history who've actually gone winless through a season. And I think my favorite Browns fan is the late Paul Stark, who grew up in Mansfield, Ohio. And in his obituary, it was noted that his condition was, quote, exacerbated by the hopeless condition of the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah, no. And the best thing about that story is he wrote that obituary before he died.
That's right. And it ends with, Paul passed just before the Browns were prepared to turn the corner. Let me tell you, it's a long corner.
Greg Popovich of the Spurs became the fifth winningest NBA coach on Tuesday night when San Antonio beat the Knicks. That win was number 1,176 for him. If the Spurs were coached by anybody else, I might say the team would suffer when its two old guys, Manu Ginobili and Tony Parker, retire. But that sort of thing doesn't seem to matter to Greg Popovich, does it?
The same thing with the San Antonio Spurs that's gone on with the New England Patriots. There's always the next guy up. And that's largely due to Greg Popovich's ability as a coach.
Last week, the Spurs honored a 100-year-old fan and a 99-year-old fan at a home game. And that's great because those two are probably old enough to remember the Spurs' first NBA title under Popovich.
That's probably true. I can't help connecting that with the story of Paul Stark in Cleveland, though, you know? He passed away and threw one more elbow on his way out the door to the Browns. And these people are going to live to see about another 12 NBA championships.
In college basketball, Louisville beat Pittsburgh by 26 points this week, but Pittsburgh head coach Kevin Stallings may have won the post-game war of words, don't you think?
Yeah, everybody's taking advantage of an opportunity to take a shot at Louisville. After the game, he said to a heckler, at least we didn't pay our kids $100,000. Now, I don't think Louisville's got the budget. Now that they're defending all these lawsuits, I don't think Louisville's got the budget to pay people $100,000 anymore, but I think Stallings made his point.
All right, here's the most surprising off-season baseball story that I've come across. Vegas bookmakers lost over $11 million in November because that was when folks who bet the Astros would win the World Series came forth to claim their winnings. I thought the wise guys in Vegas were wise. How'd that happen?
You know, you hear a story like that, and all I can think of is the line from the great Dan Jenkins, if Vegas is so smart, what's it doing in Nevada?
Chris Paul of the Houston Rockets has bought a new home,
Charlie.
That's
good to hear.
Unless it's a hotel that he's bought, because I'm looking at the photograph, and it's a little hard to tell. At least one feature of this place suggests that it could accommodate 18 couples as long as only six of them needed garage space.
Well, it's a $9 million home. It's not too far from the manse in which live the various Kardashians.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I have no idea, but in the front yard, I can't tell if this is a swimming pool or a fountain or just a lagoon. But, actually it was Avril Lavigne, the singer-songwriter, used to own this place. And it's out in Calabasas. And it really does look kind of like a La Quinta Inn. Except it has 10,400 square feet of interiors. And a great number, apparently, of bathrooms.
Yeah, too many to count, apparently. And finally, Charlie, I don't know why he waited so long after Christmas, but the Grinch is making headlines. In addition to causing problems for Who's in Whoville, he is making life more difficult for football fans in Washington. What's up with that?
Well, he's a guy named Alex Grinch, who must hate the month of December like grim death, is leaving Washington State to become Urban Meyer's co-coordinator, and I guess a defensive coordinator, at Ohio State. And so he now gets to hate the month of December in Ohio rather than Washington. If his office assistant's name is not Cindy Lou, I'm going to be very disappointed.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
So Sometimes basketball players play basketball players in the movies. Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, Kevin Durant, Shaquille O'Neal, and Ray Allen have all done that. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story of another.
By the time he was 21 years old, Bernard King had distinguished himself in two particular ways: pool hustling and scoring lots of points on the basketball court.
I didn't come from an acting background. I took one acting course in college.
A master thespian he was not, but King did co-star alongside Ernie Grunfeld on the University of Tennessee's so-called Bernie and Ernie Show basketball teams of the mid-70s. The duo averaged nearly 50 points a game for Tennessee over three seasons. King was drafted by the New Jersey Nets in 1977. During his rookie season, he established himself as a top-10 scorer. The following season looked promising, but what would King do over the summer?
There was a producer who was making a movie called Fast Break, and he was interested in having me go in for a reading.
King accepted the invitation and got into his car.
That drive through the Lincoln Tunnel from New Jersey, I started visualizing myself getting that part, and I started saying out loud, "You're going to get this. You're going to get this."
He arrived at a Manhattan hotel, found the reading room, and got in line behind about 50 other actors. After a long wait, he read for a character named Hustler.
Now, Hustler was a pool player. I played pool every day as a kid after basketball, and I developed very good skills in pool.
Bernard King says nothing ever came easy to him. Not pool, not even basketball. He had to work hard at everything he did. As a boy, he often shot hoops alone for hours, well after midnight, on the courts outside the Walt Whitman Projects in Brooklyn, where he grew up. He remembered those lessons of discipline and persistence when he was called back for a second read the next day. Only now, he'd be reading for two characters, and he didn't have much time to learn his lines.
So I stayed up all night, and on that trip back into Manhattan the next day, I went through the same process. You're going to get this. You're going to get this. Just a little bit louder, though. You're going to get this part. You want it.
This time, he read along with only five other actors.
And I received a call the next day, and it said that you received the part. And I jumped with joy.
Bernard King was in Los Angeles the following week, joining former UCLA basketball star Michael Warren, who'd later go on to television fame as Officer Bobby Hill on Hill Street Blues. Also in the cast was Harold Sylvester, a former Tulane player who'd embarked on a career as a character actor. King couldn't believe his good fortune. He was put up in a Beverly Hills apartment, and there was a weekly food stipend.
$500 a week just to eat. Now, this is 1978. How much money is that today?
Adjusting for inflation, that's about $2,000 a week, just for food, or whatever one spends money on in L.A. Not bad for a 21-year-old, but there was even more.
I'm driving a Mercedes-Benz convertible, which they paid for, and they paid me $25,000. What the hell? Now, I learned many years later, I made more than Al Pacino shooting The Godfather first movie. Yeah!
The star of Fast Break was Gabe Kaplan, best known at the time for playing the title role in Welcome Back, Kotter. And the biggest perk of all came as King relaxed in his trailer after a shoot.
I got a knock on the door. Gabe was standing at the door, and he's beaming. He's got this big smile on his face. And he said, "Bernard, what are you doing tonight?" I said, "Well, I don't have any plans." He said, "We're going to go out tonight. I'll come by and pick you up, and we'll go out and have a good time together." I didn't bother asking where he was going or where we were going. I just knew that this was going to be a fun night. He's a huge star. Everybody knows him. We're in Hollywood. We must be going someplace special. And he came by and picked me up at the appointed hour of 8 o'clock. And I go downstairs, and he's sitting in this shiny black Rolls Royce convertible. I said, "Life must be good for Gabe Kaplan." And I got in the car, and I said, "Gabe, where are we going?" He said, "We're going to the Playboy Mansion." I said, "What?" "We're going to the Playboy Mansion." We arrive at the mansion, and all kind of thoughts are going through my head. We pull up in the cobblestone driveway, and we're greeted, and our name is on the guest list. So we're escorted in, and the music's pumping. You have all these beautiful women walking all around the place, and wow. And we go and take a seat, and a gentleman came over and asked Gabe his name. And Gabe politely said, Gabe Kaplan. And I, in the meantime, noticed someone across the room. I said, wow, it looks like she's by herself. And next thing I know, Barry Gordy. You remember Barry Gordy, Gary?
Barry Gordy is the founder of Motown Records, a music legend.
He came by the table, and he wanted to say hello to Gabe. And I decided I would rather meet the woman across the room. And we hit it off quite well. And the next thing I know, I get a little tap on my shoulder. I turn around, it's Gabe. And Gabe said, let's go.
At first, King was speechless. And then he found some words.
Gabe, are you kidding me? Let's go? Why? He said, well, remember the gentleman who came over to the table to inquire what my name was? I said, yeah. He said, well, Barry Gordy sent him over because Barry Gordy didn't know who I was. And he said, I was upset because everyone knows Gabe Kaplan, but Barry Gordy didn't. So I didn't want to be there anymore. I thought, oh, my goodness, you have to be kidding me. We left the Playboy Mansion for that? I wanted to hit him upside his head. But all I could do was just sit there quietly because he was kind enough to invite me, and I had to work with him the next day.
Ah, right, work. There was an actual movie to shoot in between episodes of Frolicsome L.A. Fun, including the scenes King considers his favorites. Like the one in which he draws on his Brooklyn pool hustling experience and runs the table against an opponent. The scene barely needed to be edited because King made every shot but one.
And I remember using some slang in that scene. I said, solid.
Rack 'em up.
All right, solid.
Rack 'em up, solid. Yeah. Here's another $20.
And that was not in the script. And that meant, you know, great, okay, wonderful. In my neighborhood growing up, that's what that meant, solid. And so I thought I flubbed the line. And a director said, no, I love it. We're going to keep that. Use it all the time when you think it should be incorporated into a scene. So now what? I'm producing scenes?
Fast Break wrapped up filming in the summer of 1978. King loved that experience, but there was one problem.
For 3 months, essentially, I didn't work out. When you're shooting a movie and you have basketball scenes, that's wonderful, but that's not training. So consequently, when I returned to the NBA following that movie, I was not in shape, and so I got off to a slow start.
But that slow start didn't last long. King again averaged more than 20 points a game, and the New Jersey Nets made the playoffs. Fast Break hit the theaters in March of 1979. Some of the reviews were good.
I probably should have hired an agent, and I should have hired an acting coach, but I was more interested in being a great basketball player.
That choice worked out pretty well for Bernard King. He played 14 seasons in the NBA and was a 4-time All-Star with the Warriors, Knicks, and Bullets. King was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in 2013. He's now a broadcaster with NBA TV and the MSG Network, which leaves him little time to think about what Al Pacino makes per movie these days.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach talking with Bernard King. You can learn more about King in his new autobiography, Game Face. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. In our final word, Bernard King describes one of the most memorable scenes from Fast Break, in which he and his fictional college basketball teammates attempt to ingest a pound of marijuana while being followed by a police cruiser with its sirens blaring.
That was one of the most memorable scenes of the movie, but had explained to everyone that was not weed, it was wheat.
Okay, so one requirement for joining that cast is you had to be okay with gluten, I guess. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.